You can use the mic. Hello. Where's the mic? It's over there. You gotta turn it on first. Green light. There you go.
Good evening. How are y'all? Welcome to the Dallas Philosophers Forum, 2017 edition. I'm David Alkeck, the president. And so I'd like to welcome any newcomers. Who's new to our thing? Raise your hand. Good.
I'm out. Second time.
Second time. All right. Where did you hear from about us?
A neighborhood website. I can't think of the name of it.
Okay. Great.
This is where you're going to report being broken into or something.
Okay.
They said, while you're at it, go to Philosopher's Forum.
Great. How did you hear about us?
Actually, I was eating here one time and saw the sign. And
wonderful.
It was something I thought I'd be interested in, but it took me a long time to finally show up.
That's great.
Well, we expect to see you.
Yes.
Keith invited us, and we know Skip. And
wonderful. Okay. Anybody else? Yes.
I heard about it on the website.
Okay. We're not all stuffy philosophers. I'm not a philosopher myself. And all of our talks are about philosophy. Sometimes we have science, religion, even poetry, all kinds of things of interest. But some have something to do with philosophy anyway. We have been going for 35 plus years, I believe. Yeah, 40 years. Dr. Bob Berman is our emeritus emeritus member and past president.
Not just 39 years.
39 years. So we do have. Yes, he's deserved applause. And he is a professional philosopher.
Thank you,
professor. philosophy is not free. We do have our expenses, so if you haven't paid your admission to David Drum here, and if you're a full-time student, you get a discount. So I'm going to introduce our speaker, who happens to be a past president of the Dallas Philosopher Forum for about 6 years. Is that right, Andrew? He has a degree in physics from the University of Texas at Dallas. You know, for so long, when I was coming and he was the president, I thought, sure, he was a philosopher, because he had, at that time, he's kind of cleaned up his act a little bit. He had a ponytail, and I thought, he's got to be a philosopher. But sure enough, he's a real scientist. He also serves on the board of the North Texas Chapter of the Congress of the New Urbanism and earned a graduate certificate in city planning from UTD as well. He did his undergraduate and graduate work at the University of Texas at Dallas. Born in El Paso, raised in Dallas, he now does software engineering. And so without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Andrew Laska.
Testing, testing. You hear that?
You're good.
You hear it?
We can turn you up if we need to.
That's it? Can you guys hear me in the back?
Yeah.
Good, okay. I'm a little kind of deceptive being up here. Doing that. So I'm going to put my...
Some of us are the front end.
Okay. I'll do my best. There's a little timer here. As David mentioned, I'm past president, and as I see lots of familiar faces here. Of course, lots of new faces who don't know me. And so I appreciate the Philosopher's Forum inviting me back to speak. So I'm glad to see it's still going, and after years and years, when I became involved, I was standing on the shoulders of others in the past, and Now I'm not around as much, and other people, I guess, kind of stood on the shoulders of us. And hopefully that keeps going. So, with no further ado, most of you have seen the topic I'm going to speak on. I called it Welcome to the Post-Philosophy World. I always like to put a good kicker in there for a title. You know, we've all heard those great words, fact-check, and post-fact, and post-truth, and scientific denial. These things are going around in recent popular press, and I had to write, including in handwritten on here, I had to write alternative facts on my
alternative facts
on here. Just in. And so, what do all these words have in common? So, and by the way, I like to be interactive, so I'm going to ask you questions. What do all these words have in common? And not that we hear them recently. That's not what I mean. What do they have in common? Someone venture a guess.
Lies.
Lies. What's that? Okay, now. Trying to get to a specific thing. Some of those may be true, but that's not what I'm getting. Yes?
Could say it's splitting ideology from facts.
No. I'm thinking more general than that. Way more general.
Question.
What do all these have in common?
Post.
What
are the words again?
Fact check, post-fact, post-truth, scientific denial, and our favorite recent one, alternative facts.
Facts,
yes.
Global warming. So what I'm trying to get to is they all have philosophical language. And that's the thing, is that here we have these words which pop out in popular culture and in the news, and New York Times, somebody writes an editorial about working in the post-fact world or whatever it is, and they... But they're talking about something that's grounded in philosophical language, right? Which is an unusual thing. Usually we don't talk about that sort of thing. And so this is a talk going to be about, it's going to be a talk of philosophy, but it's also going to be about philosophy. Okay, so we're going to have some meta talk here, because we're going to talk about philosophy as both noun and verb. Okay? And so when I say post-philosophy, basically what I'm saying, and I'll kind of flesh this out a little bit, is that the state of philosophy as noun and verb coming into disrepair in our culture. It's in a state of disrepair. So philosophy is a noun. So when we say noun, it's basically something that's distinguishable from some other thing. That's what we could mean by a noun. And so we can distinguish, for example, you know, methods of laying pipe in the backyard, or a narrative about, let's say, war, or a narrative about sex. Or discussions of this, of course, unfortunately the latter will not be involved here. There's discussions about certain topics that we call those philosophy. Okay? And so those are distinguishable from each other, so that makes them a noun. Okay? So, but we can use philosophy as a verb. So you notice those things I made, methods of laying a pipe, of narratives, they're not like a noun like a chair, like I can grab a chair. But, you know, having a narrative, is still a noun. It's a thing we can identify separate from some other thing. Having a narrative about war is different than me pronouncing the words, you know, I pronounce you man and wife. That's very different. Okay? So the philosophy can also be a verb, right? We do philosophy. We do it as an act. Okay? And so we hope tonight, as we're here, we're doing philosophy as an act. So and philosophy is a human activity. Right? It's not found in nature. So heat is found in nature. So our measurement of heat may not be found in nature, but we can sort of generally accept that there's at least one property of a glacier, let's say, in a sandy desert, and they differ by one property, at least one property. We call that heat. And that's going to be true whether there's human beings around or not. Right? So philosophy is not like that. It's a human endeavor. No human, no philosophy. Okay? So that's kind of a first premise, and I'm going to set up some premises here, which of course is always dangerous in philosophy because then you get to knock me down, right? And so I'm up for it, though. So since philosophy is a human game, I'm going to segue to the next, and the next one's a little more dicey premise, and then I'm going to say that the dominant civilizational influence across the world is Western civilization, okay? And to be more precise, what I mean is the dominant elements that are present in the greatest amount of geography and human interactions across the globe, such to say that they are dominant, are ideas and concepts developed primarily in Western civilization. So that's what I mean by dominant. Okay. Well, Western civilization as opposed to what? Well, we give other examples. Okay, but Indian civilization and Chinese. So in India, I don't see anybody of Indian origin in the room, but tell me. But, you know, the BC, we would refer to as BC, you know, they had a Vedic civilization and it gave way to a dynastic civilization. It had its own ideas about governments, got music, trade, so on. They're all set different from the West. Okay. And they don't necessarily define philosophy the same way we do. But nonetheless, they had ideas we would identify as philosophy in that wheelhouse, quite well developed. Okay. And China is the same way. Same topics, government, music, so on. We could, you know, talk about all the different ones. Now, again, the philosophical ideas of China, not necessarily approaching them the same way we do in the West. Okay. But nonetheless, as humans, we moved along, we moved towards what we call modernity, became ideas in the West, some philosophical, some not, that sort of became dominant. They're more dominant around the globe as it is today. So what did I not say when I said all this? I didn't say all civilization is Western. I didn't say it was superior or better. I didn't say anything about race. Okay, I didn't say I preferred it, or I didn't say I was critical of it. Okay, I didn't say that the state of affairs occurred through just means or without hegemony or without displacing or decimating other civilizing frameworks. I mean, though that did happen, right? Perhaps even happens today, right? I didn't say Western ideas are purely, quote, Western in origin. Okay, so it's ideas in, you know, Western civilizations, like any other civilization, they're not like this and little separate things. They're like this. They mesh and they interact, and we get influence from others, and, you know, likewise. I mean, our numbers are a great example. We call our numbers Arabic numbers, right? It's a whole history about where our written numbers come from. Okay. So in any case, but nonetheless, it's dominant. Okay, and so. So what I'm sort of getting to is this is a state of affairs, like it or not, better or worse, till death do us part. Okay, that's the way it is. Now it could change. 100 years later, you know, Chinese ideas could wander around the globe, India and Islamic even could wander around the globe. It could be a mishmash where there's not one thing dominant around the globe. But the way it is now, methods of trade, we negotiate, talk to each other, very often Western. Okay? So one example coming from the West is science. Okay, so science as we know it, and as we philosophize about it, it's primarily developed in the West. Okay? So it goes into other cultures like Southeast Asia and so on, but nonetheless it was initially developed in the West. Another is democracy, right? Democracy. Greek. Democracies, right? I mean, this, you know, Western countries, you know, they don't get involved with overthrowing other governments, by and large, and if there's some country that wants to change its form of government, typically what do? They add democratic elements, and they recognize that as democratic elements. Nobody really ever goes back to, you know, the God declares, you know, who's going to be the tribal elders. No one goes that direction, really. Okay? Typically, they go towards democracy. Okay? Is it possible they would? Sure. North Korea? Yeah, a little weird there, right? But the point is dominant. Okay. So we can talk about music, we can talk about all sorts of topics, but democracy and science are two good pull points. So Western civilization is at this point dominant. Okay? So an important rung in the Western ladder is how we approach philosophy. Okay, so it's again different from these others. And so we have our own unique approaches. Compared to these other civilizations, and well, that may not be academically dominant worldwide. If you go into Asia, they may not study it the same way as we do. I don't know what they might do in Indian universities. They may not study it the same way. But nonetheless, some of these elements we talk about, such as science or governance, we spend a lot of time justifying them with philosophy, right? We just don't say, oh, that's, science is great, and democracy was great, and we spent a lot of time in the background justifying these things. And we justify them in the realm of philosophy. Okay? So now what I hear you saying is, you know, well, we're here today in 2017, and you're saying about, you know, Western ideas are dominant, but philosophy isn't respected. Nobody cares about philosophy. They care about Donald Trump tweeting stuff. They care about pop stars. Until recently, they cared about Kim Kardashian. Right? She had some unfortunate issues and whatnot, and so I'm not trying to pick on her. But the point is that, you know, the average Joe on the street does not care about philosophy, right? And so, so my response to that is the West, despite being the cradle for these sort of, you know, these incredible development of the human intellect, this part of it, and in this way, has always had a love-hate relationship with philosophy. So this is this part just that part is not new, right? And so here's the more interactive part. So name the two most famous executions in Western history.
Executions.
Socrates.
Leonardo Bruno.
Okay, so Socrates is one. Second one is
Jesus.
Jesus and Socrates are the two big executions of Western history. Okay. So Jesus is probably bigger in a historical sense because, you know, the West was dominated by Christianity. But nonetheless, they both, by the way, have similarities to them if you unpack them and think about them. We don't have time for that. But yeah, the one we're concerned with in philosophy, particularly, is Socrates, right? And so why is this famous? Well, he represents dying for standing with his ideas, right? His charges were trumped up against him, no pun intended. You know, he didn't use legalisms, you know, hire the lawyer to get out so he therefore would win, right? I mean, he accepted his fate at the hands of people who were essentially lesser minds than him, and essentially he becomes immortal. He becomes a transcendent symbol of the power of ideas and the commitment to ideas, right? And it cost him his life. So this is a powerful symbol of Western philosophy, right? And so right from the start, they want to kill us, okay? And I'm not really kidding. That's from the start, you know, philosophers, I mean, someone else would mention Giordano, I'm sorry, Bruno back there in the corner, somebody, I don't know who it was. That's another example. You know, we can name lots of examples where someone forwarding certain ideas and certain frameworks didn't get quite respected, and a lot of it was about the ideas themselves, okay? So, but humans, after all, are animals, right? And we have an animal nature. Okay, so, you know, we hoard, we give into fear, we strike out at others, and some of us try to dominate others just in the same way that many species, you know, that someone tries to rise to the alpha status, the alpha male status. And I assume there's some species that has alpha female status, but I'm not a biologist, but I presume that's true. And one view of the Western philosophy is that it works against that, right? We try to make sense and order of the world, and it's an expression of fulfilling sort of higher nature as in humans. Okay? Dogs don't, as far as we know, don't philosophize. You know, cockroaches don't philosophize as we do, and if they did, that would be pretty weird. But you know, so the idea of the role it plays is we should consider it a, you know, one of the highest expressions of human nature, of being a human being. Right, and as you know, physicist Richard Feynman said, "We're atoms with curiosity," which is itself a stunning thought. Right, we come from the stars, and we are atoms that we think back on those stars and think about ourselves. And so what do we do in Western philosophy? Okay, I mean, what's one of the key actions? Right, we ask questions, and so historically we break those into specific categories. So now here is the, I'm going to ask you a question, you're going to tell me which branch of philosophy game. Okay? So here's the question. What is there?
Teleology.
Metaphysics.
Now?
Ontology.
Okay. What does it mean to know something? Or how do we know?
Epistemology,
right? What should I do or what should I not do?
That's right.
So you go, but as all God, right? And then there's no rules about these categories. These are categories by tradition. They could have been other categories. And there are other categories people can throw out there. I mean, I've heard one or two different answers. And those are not wrong answers, right? When people get to specific branches of philosophy, they'll make, you know, environmental philosophy. Then we talked about governance, right? That's a political philosophy is a field, right? So So in any case, you know, this is what we do. We ask questions. So, you know, in the background, irrelevant to sort of what we're talking about today. One other part that's sort of more unique to the West, which ties these together, okay, and that is reason and logic. Okay, so I mentioned these other cultures. Western philosophy really, more than any other civilization on Earth, develops reason and logic as a category in and of itself. Okay, so it thinks of reason in and of itself. Now the Indians did do that a bit, but it's a little different. Okay. And it becomes sort of the central linchpin of Western thinking. Okay? Reason and logic. So we sort of broke it off into its own category. And so we even give like names to these bits of logic, and they stand cognitively on their own. Okay, so when I talked about doing philosophy, it's important to think that you learn these bits of logic, learn how to reason as a skill. So it wasn't an accident I mentioned laying pipe or having a narrative. I mean, what's the verb version of a narrative? It's telling a story, right? There's a skill to telling a better story, right? But there's a skill to using reason and logic, right? So it's something we can learn and teach. And we have methods of that. So like farming or weaving or woodworking, we treat it like a skill. So an example of, if I had a slide projector, you know, worth having a slide projector for two slides. So, but, you know, modus ponens, right? Here we are, and in fact, this is a logic book in the back room. You were talking about this. Modus ponens, right? And so it's a form of an argument, right? P implies Q. P is true, therefore Q is true. Or, more casually, if A then B, A is true, therefore B is true. And that's modus ponens, right? That form of an argument which we can teach. So I can say, and everybody in the room will get this, right? If it is raining, then the streets are wet. It is raining, therefore,
the streets are wet,
right? So this is reason. And so reason and logic, and we could have a whole talk and bore you to death and you fall asleep, hearing about modus tollens and a bunch of other forms of argument, right? But the point is, this is a very key part of Western philosophy, is that it deals with reason and logic, okay? Much more than the others. So in Western philosophy, we have this sort of sub-demand, things be rational, consistent, and coherent. So we make arguments that are all of those things. And it's either implied in what the philosopher is telling us, or it's explicit. So oftentimes it's explicit. And so let me give you I want to go through some quick examples of Western philosophy in context as noun and verb, and we can kind of talk about that. But this part of this is about philosophy. So it existing as a practice in the West is part of my point. Okay. So example number one is the ontological argument for the existence of God. Okay. And so that argument kind of goes, God is a being with public. A being than which nothing greater can be conceived. And since a God exists, since I can conceive of this God, and if a God didn't exist, that would be lesser, that is to say, it would not be greater, right? So that would not be the greatest being. Therefore, since I can't conceive of this God, God must exist. That's sort of a brief form of the argument. And the idea was to produce argument for God purely from reason. And there's many forms of this argument. That's kind of one of mine. And, you know, and actually to write it out, there's like 9 propositions you follow, and we don't have time for that. But the point is, you know, it's sort of this thought experiment. Now, if the philosopher's form is to have a debate about God right up here, so, and this was to be one of the arguments, right? So who would stand on the pro-ontological argument side? Who might stand on that side? Give me a guess. What sort of person?
What was your question?
If the philosopher's form was to have a debate about the existence of God, and if we were to have one of the points would be about the ontological argument, on the pro side, we would have what sort of person?
A religious person.
Or a
philosopher
of
religion.
Right, so something of that nature. A Christian apologist, perhaps. Right? Or an apologist for that, but it doesn't have to be Christian, right? Okay, so on the anti-side, who might we have? Scientist or a?
An atheist,
right. So that's who we conceive of, right? But let's talk about the history of this argument. So this is the first version of this argument that we know about was Anselm, who was the Archbishop of Canterbury in the 11th century. Okay, so he comes up with his argument. In his one of his contemporaries, Guenilo, I'm not very good at pronouncing French places, Marmature, argues against this. Okay? His argument against this was, well, this argument holds and we can have all sorts of other perfect things, like a perfect island or a perfect donut or something. So those must exist too, right? And so the point is that Anselm was the Archbishop of Canterbury. Guenilo was, in fact, a French Benedictine monk. Okay? So it wasn't the apologist and the atheist we would see in contemporary. It was both religious people, right, arguing this point. So one religious guy is arguing against the other, says, you know, your method of proving God exists is nonsense, right? And the point being is that they're doing philosophy not because they have some predisposition to say, well, you're wrong because I don't believe in God. It's because he wants to get the belief right, right? And that's an important point. So when we do philosophy, we spend a certain amount of time, we need to detach ourselves from our biases and from our emotion, because one of the purposes, we want to be rational, we want to be coherent, consistent, rational, to get the beliefs right, right? That's part of what they're doing. Whether we agree or not is not relevant to the, it's not. It's an art and a practice and a skill that we want, to carry forward, right? So, well, so what? Ontological argument, so what? It doesn't mean much. Okay, so let's go on to another example. Newton. Okay, and so the story here is a little shorter, a little more obtuse maybe, but you know, Newton's publishing Principia, where he basically tells us his famous three laws and the idea of inverse square laws of planetary motion, which of course sets off one of the things that sets off, there's many things, but one of the things that sets off revolutions in science, right? But there's a much more long-involved story about Newton and Edmund Halley and Robert Hooke and the Royal Society about getting his work published, okay? And so we need to keep in mind how important Principia is, and that this becomes the intellectual basis for, you know, this, right? The microphone I'm speaking of and the lights, I mean, it becomes this thing which the world we inhabit today is very much rests upon Newton's publishing of Principia, okay? Because it lays the intellectual, I mean, obviously, Newton's laws of motion, we don't worry about that when we build the phone, we worry about electronics, but the point is the intellectual methodology, the philosophy which came out of that, becomes extremely important, okay? And so, of course, Newton doesn't know this at the time. And so enter Historia Piscium, or The History of Fishes, which is a book published by the Royal Society, beautiful engravings of fish species. You can get it on now. It's on the internet now. You can look at it. These things were drawn back in the time. And what happened was the Royal Society blew their entire publishing budget publishing this book. And so Newton's book was almost never published. So think about that. It had nothing to do with philosophy at all. Right? Nothing to do with the quality of its ideas. So Edmund Halley, to the rescue, gets a bunch of money and some story, and it gets published. Okay. So just because we have great ideas that are useful, transmittable, teachable, does not mean they inevitably hold or we inevitably get to them. Okay. So I want that to point out in terms of our history. We're standing here in this certain moment in time where we're concerned with ideas and truth, but just because we're concerned with ideas and truth and we have these values about truth, other people may not, doesn't mean that it's going to win the day. And this is an example of that. History might have been slightly different and we might have, who knows, how long would it have taken us to get where we are today, right? So let me give one last example here that's kind of a little, come to the point, is that, so let me kind of analogize again about philosophy in that, you know, we teach kids to sort of play the kid, you know, everybody's not a great philosopher, right? Everybody's not a great thinker, okay? And that, we teach a lot of kids, for example, to play the violin, right? And some do okay, and some good, and some give up, and some are pushed by their parents or whatever, right? And some go on to playing in adulthood. So how many Itzhak Perlmans come out of that, right? Okay. And how many Anybody know who Jacqueline Dupree is?
Yeah.
Oh, very good.
Chelsea.
Impressed. Chelsea, very good. So how many of those come out, right?
Well,
not a lot, right? Even though we're spreading this thing about, you know, as a culture, we allow this and people learn to music, right? So we get occasionally the greatness comes out of it. So we have these institutions in the culture. And it doesn't matter whether we're in the West or Indian or whatnot, but nonetheless, these institutions are out there, and then occasionally greatness rises up in that skill. And philosophy is the same way, right? So without the background Newton was working in, where these kind of ideas were successful and could be published, for that matter, like a Royal Society being there, that never would have happened, right? And so that transmits to us the importance of having that intellectual framework in the culture, right? Because without that intellectual framework, so you may think, well, I don't care that this dope learns modus ponens in a college classroom. And why do I care that this somebody learns, uses Kant to learn about moral reason, even though we don't really think Kant's method of moral reasoning is that good? Because at some later time, one of those 100 students is going to be the guy who comes up with a great idea. Right.
And where
he's going to maintain something about the guy who inspires everybody to understand about truth in itself, of itself, for example.
So that's kind of what my point about Newton is here. So let me give one last example. Okay, so I'm going to read some words to you. These are words you've probably heard before. So let me read these words. When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Okay, we've all heard those words. So I'm going to ask you another question. What about those words, right? So these are words which were written down, sent to the King of England, published and sent around our certain colonies we know about, right? And they're heavily philosophically weighted, right? This is not just, you know, this is not a comment someone left on Facebook, right? This is like a significant thing put out into the popular culture where the men writing this had specific ideas in mind. And we can, of course, gel back and try to figure out what those are, you know. Laws of nature and of nature God. That's very interesting. It doesn't say God and laws of nature. Is the order important? It says laws of nature first, then of nature's God. Does that mean something? Right? So we ask these questions. I mean, what makes it convincing, right? These truths are self-evident. Really, what does it mean to be self-evident, right? That itself is a striking statement. And what are these statements that are equality, right? Liberty. Human beings should be in a state of liberty. That no one has a right to compel them away from happiness. Okay, and these rights, in fact, come from what? Come from what? Creator. Right. So they're endowed by the Creator. Right. And so those have all sorts of philosophical weight. So that's great. We have, and I could have picked you can pick out whole sorts of examples in Western history, right? So the ontological argument. So what? Newton, okay, we're getting a thing where it's important we transmit the ideas, and here's something that has weight to this day, right? These ideas we're thinking about have weight to this day. So that these men operated in a background where it was permissible for them to transmit these ideas with a philosophical background, okay? And if philosophy had not been respected in these ideas, thinking about laws of nature and of nature's God and saying that a creator endowed them, they would have written this differently. Okay. Or maybe not written at all, who knows? But the point being is to really believe these ideas, we have to have a philosophical idea to make them, philosophical ideas to make them believable, because they're not obvious claims contained in this. And so we like to call the United States the American experiment, but it rests, as I said, on the Western history where there's philosophical advancement and there's a practice threaded all the way back. Daniel, what the guy's name who does the philosophy series and great lecture series, Daniel somebody. But he opens that lecture series by saying,
you know, the philosophy is the longest intellectual conversation in human history. In fact, it went right up until this morning, meaning that it hasn't ceased, right? And we hope that it hasn't ceased, by the way. So, without this historic thread of philosophy, there's no United States. That's a pretty striking statement, right? And then the United States, as a democracy, has in fact been symbolic for other democracies. We went into France. Well, the Revolution of France wasn't quite so pretty, a little messed up, but nonetheless, that's where it went, okay? And so did King George get this in his rational mind? Did he say, oh, what the heck, you know, good thinking chaps, you guys got it, good luck. Is that what happened? No. Basically, what did he say? He said, kill the philosophers. That was his response. Right. And so here we are in 2017, and between that founding time, and we've had civil war, two world wars, we fought slavery. You know, we've outright avoided communism, socialism during the Depression. It was very possible that we slipped into that direction, right, during the Depression, right? Because that was a force going on in the country. You know, we established public education, and part of that was, in fact, you know, one little tiny little slice of that is what? Geometry. Why did we choose to teach geometry? You know, most of you, some of you are older than me, and some of you are about my age, and I look a little older than I look. But why do we teach geometry?
Reason.
Logic and reason, right. So that's why we teach it. So I think if you go now and you look at geometry, it's not quite the same. But the point is, that was one of the tip of the hat to the clear thinking. And that part of the purpose of education was to make a full human being, and part of making a full human being was clear thinking, right? So, now, so here we are now in 2017, this post-philosophy world. Now, I can't necessarily come up with all the reasons. You've heard my background. I'm not a PhD. I'm not sitting around getting to study this all day and figure out the reasons, right? Maybe if I was, I would be right enough. But there's a couple of few ideas about how philosophy ended up getting pushed to the side, okay? So one interesting view is a guy named John McCumber, and so he wrote a book, it was about 15 years ago, called Time in the Ditch. Has anyone heard of this book? Okay. So he argues that American philosophy accelerated sort of its decline when it sort of changed, it sort of had this cleaving between analytic philosophy and continental philosophy. So analytic philosophy then gets involved with everything is a problem of language, and everything's going to be this hardcore argument, and continental philosophy is what we really, frankly, traditional think of philosophy as, Descartes and all these things in the past, okay? I'm doing continental philosophy, really, okay? So, but he argues that this cleaving happens during the McCarthy era, okay? And that you had to have safe ideas, right? By the way, think Galileo's, right? And analytic philosophy, that is abstraction, is not the same as continental philosophy. Of course, continental philosophy produced stuff like Heidegger. Heidegger was a Nazi, okay? I don't mean that as an insult. If you guys don't know, Heidegger was a Nazi. Right? There's pictures of him wearing Nazi uniforms, right? And so, you know, he argues that this became how philosophy got mired in the mud academically in the United States. So this is one thing. I'm not going to say I agree or disagree. This is just somebody's theory. Okay, it's not my theory. And he points out, like, between 1992 and 1996, you know, over 100 philosophy departments in the United States closed. Okay. Close. It's gone. Okay. So another theory is that you can find some of these theories if you search around the internet. People write academic papers about them. So one is that universities sort of shifted to becoming job factories. Again, post-World War II, Cold War kind of thing. Also inequality kind of thing. Instead of producing an educated public that's enculturating you with broad skills and broad culture, the purpose shifts to students being customers and preparing them for a job. Of course, you care about this all the time. I got to go to college because I want to get a good job, right? Requirements that, you know, we'd be able to reason and that we'd have liberal arts pursuits. It's a tongue twister. Just for the, frankly, the sake of carrying on culture and uplifting it, and that you might be interested in it, you know, sort of fell to the side. And students want majors that get them the highest salary. Okay, and you can, of course, go on the internet and say, what college degrees get me the most money? Which college degree shouldn't you have? Right? And those are all round about what the salaries are and what the good job prospects are, of course, a reasonable thing to say. And that's one other theory. Another theory revolves around mass media. So around, again, after World War II, probably a little bit before World War II with radio, I mean, mass media starts to come into vogue here. We particularly television, but other kinds of media, you know, mass consumption of music, you know, cheap printed materials. You go into the supermarket, you know, before printed media started to go down. Right, you all know this. You could get tons of magazines, right? And of course, social media is kind of replacing some of this, right? It's a cheap form of easy media, right? I can get like tons of garbage right here. Okay. And sadly, I probably look at it too much. And so, of course, then what happens is the culture, this ends up pushing out other forms of us, you sitting there contemplatively and doing stuff, right? Because people are occupied literally with doing other junk. Okay, so that's another theory. So, anyway, none of these are my theories, and other people produce and flesh these theories out, and there's probably a little bit of truth to all of them, right? One way or another, maybe some issues with some of them. But you know, we talk about ideas today, and we're talking about, you know, we hear, you know, we've got this, we're a polarized society, and there's liberals on one side, conservatives on the other, this group on this side, and this on another, and they don't listen to each other, they don't even listen to each other's ideas. We hear these sort of cognitive and neurological studies. You know, they have cognitive bias, right? And you all have no doubt seen or heard these sort of experiments where, you know, we did sort of things to try to get people to pay attention to other people's opinions, you know, measuring whether they're in a certain particular political view or religious view or whatever, are they even going to listen to the other side? And they kind of, we have these sort of studies that get done, which they sort of suggest that most people don't, or lots of people don't. And so some of these studies are good, and some of them are silly. The example of a silly one I heard recently was offering a small sample of people to pay them to hear other ideas, you know, and like they would pay them this token amount, like between $5 and $10 or something, right? And using that with sort of suggesting, well, you know, we need to pay them to listen to other people's ideas. So people are, this majority of the people, 60-some-odd percent, were narrow-minded. We're going to generalize this idea, and that just is, strikes me as having a physics background as being a silly experiment. But there's lots of these, right? But I want to make a point about those and why that philosophers particularly should resist those kind of things. They may be true. Okay, maybe true as a phenomenon, right? But there's also true as a phenomenon. We're part animals, right? We hoard and do all those things. We do worse things. We rape and we do these human beings do these terrible things, right? We have animal nature, okay? And just because we have, maybe this is part of our animal nature too, but just because it's there doesn't mean we don't aspire to higher, you know, our higher selves, which is what I'm trying to point out philosophy is. It's so of course in philosophy you want to make an argument to convince other people to hear your views, right? But again, it's a set of things and activities. So you learn the tools of reason, right? You learn to ask questions, okay? You learn to recognize problems. In fact, one of my props I forgot to bring was a book. It's a little thin book. It's this thin, little tiny paperback called Writing Philosophy. It's written by a philosophy professor, and he wrote it for graduate students, or students wanting to be graduate students in philosophy. And so in the book, it's a great book if you can get it. It's called Writing Philosophy, very simple title. I don't remember the name of the author. But in the book, he says, what I do when I want to write a recommendation letter to a student who wants to go to the graduate philosophy department, if I want to recommend him, I make sure I say quite prominently he understands what a philosophical problem is. Okay, so that's a skill of philosophy, is understanding that this is some certain thing is a philosophical problem, right? The point being is that, again, the point of it being a skill, okay? Those are things we practice. I hope by being here, you're helping practice, and I'm helping you practice, and you help me, right? Because again, we continue to do this, and we continue to have it in our culture, and occasionally some great person will come out, or more people will learn how to reason, okay? They won't just accept something because they read it on Facebook, or question it. So, So let's go back to science, right? So science, I have a degree in physics. So you ask a scientist to justify science. So what is the relevance today? Well, if they don't brush you off, which they might do, which professional scientists have brushed me off when I ask them that question, and some have, but many do not. They engage the question. And so what they will have to do at that point, what will they have to do at that point? Okay? What will the scientists have to do to justify science? They'll have to make philosophical arguments. So even though the scientist is not a professional philosopher to justify their own practice, they have to make philosophy. They have to step into philosophy to do it. Right? It's just not a rote thing. Okay? And so they can't even justify their own profession without the existence of philosophy. That's, I think, an extremely important point. Okay? So religion and public life is another thing that we hear about, right? So as it goes without saying, the tools of philosophy are necessary to justify positions about religion. Certainly religion and public life. And by public life, I don't mean like in the government. I mean just out in the world. Okay? But, you know, the religionists, you know, we would generally accept that, if, you know, depending on, it doesn't matter what religion you are, Jewish or Christian or whatever, that, it's useless if you're just blindly obedient to this stuff, right? So most religionists are going to think and say, I'm going to have some arguments about why it is I believe these things, right? And so even forwarding ideas of religion in public life, trying to convince others, is going to be stepping into the realm of philosophy. Okay. And so that's an American life. And then you have, of course, the other side. Some folks are going to say, look, the religion is just this different activity, and maybe there's a social aspect to it, but there's no supernatural forces and God doesn't exist. But they, too, have to step into the framework of philosophy to justify that position. Right. So the point being is that these are a rich part in American life. Okay, and so this is necessary. And so, so politics being another one, right? So politics, we argue in America right now, and of course, as you're well aware of, and it's not really in the realm of philosophy the way it generally gets discussed, right? You know, get insults, you know, you're a libertard, and you're a Republican, blah, 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 right? Hillary's a liar, Trump is an egomaniac. Okay. Well, all of those things may be true, but the fact that that is not particularly intellectually enlightening for us deciding what's the proper form of governance. Philosophers should bring it to a different level, right? Well, what are rights anyway? What are these things? How would I even know what a right is? Right? Attacking that would be an interesting way to talk about healthcare, because there's people who believe that healthcare is a right. Well, ask them to justify it. There's people who believe the opposite. Healthcare is not a right, but the government should provide. So talking about what in fact is a right, stripping away the specifics of healthcare, raises the conversation to the level which, you know, we start to go back to more of the roots of the American founding with the words I read to you earlier. Starts to move us that direction, right? So, of course, truth. Right? Post-truth, fact, right? And it's shocking that we have to discuss truth as a value. And that's probably the shockingest thing to me, you know. Not that people voted for certain people. Certain have always voted for this person or that person and not voted for this person, you know. Long before I was born. But truth as a value. Okay. So, well, in philosophy, we ask, what is truth, right? And so there's, you know, how do I know a proposition is true or not, right? So if you go talk to a person on the street, how do you know something's true? Yeah, well, I Google it. Well, is that really the way to do it, right? What does it mean for something to be true, aside from Google? Before Google, did people not know stuff was true, right? So, you know, there's opportunities to bring in philosophy and this higher level thinking into the conversation. So, you know, in Western philosophy, there's theories of truth, right? There's a correspondence theories of truth, for example, the state of affairs of the world, you know, that it corresponds to the claim, typically through observation, that is true, right? And there's the coherence theory of truth. Does the claim cohere with other known true claims, right? So, like, so when someone says, well, they're alternative facts, right? Are they inherently, like, talking about coherence theory of truth or correspondence theory of truth, right? Interesting. So, but all told, we appear to be in a time which, in philosophy, when, as John McCumber said, we're in the ditch, right? Because we're not really talking about these things at this high level, right? And so my suggestion is, it's your duty to keep it up, and it's your duty to ask and talk about these kind of questions, and bring that to a high level. Strip off your particular political leanings, or even your religious leanings, and, you know, talk about these things at a high level, higher level. You know, how do I know things? What are the tools by which I can know? You know, what words are used? What are their real meanings? You know, unpacking the meaning, alternative fact, right? You know, Merriam-Webster has a Twitter feed, and they tweeted about what the definition of fact was, because everybody was sort of looking at fact. And fact is something that is universal, something, I don't remember the exact definition, but just work with me. Universal agreement that it corresponds with reality. So alternative fact. Well, if a fact is something that corresponds with reality, and there can be alternative facts, what does that say about reality? Alternative realities. Okay? So, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, there's alternative realities or anything, but the point is that when you start to unpack them, look at the statements philosophically, they have different meaning, right? And that maybe is, in fact, a way to argue with someone. This is crazy. It's not crazy because alternative fact is just a falsehood. Because alternative fact means that there's multiple versions of objective reality out there. Right? Do you really believe there's objective versions of multiple? No. Well, okay, then how are you going to resolve this? Right? That's approaching that in a philosophical way. Okay. So in any case, so my point is, we're not going to solve any immediate problems necessary to sort of keep these tools alive, but we're going to work on them, and we're going to be some of the folks that can do that, right? And so that's really kind of the gist of my talk, okay, is that where are we going, how we got here, and to kind of frame the idea of Western philosophy in this way in which we did. So I thank you very much.
Anybody have a question?
Yes. Can you think of a time and a place where the man on the street cared about philosophy?
I can think of a time on the street. Well, I think in the past, there's times when more people on the street cared about philosophy. And so there's been some writing about the, I forgot the term, but the homegrown intellectual. The American homegrown intellectual, okay, in which ideas were produced and weren't produced by educated people. They published books or published works. You know, without necessarily having training, right? And so a good example of a field that interests me recently is urban planning. And one is Jane Jacobs, right? So Jane Jacobs was a journalist. She lived in Scranton, Pennsylvania, moved to Brooklyn. You know, she got a job through some various contacts with, I believe it was Architectural Review magazine, so she began to understand about buildings and cities a little bit. As an amateur, without training, and she moved to Brooklyn, and a guy by the name of Robert Moses, who was a parks director for the city of Newark, plowing freeways through the existing neighborhoods, wanted to plow with their herds, and she fought this. Part of the result of that was her book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And that is a tour de force of a book. I mean, go get that book, you open it to any page, and you're looking at this going, oh my God, this is just, I'm going to say this phrase, and I'm going to mean it in a certain way, is she was a housewife, okay? And what do I mean by that? I mean that was at one hearing when Robert Moses was being beaten, he allegedly screamed out, "Nobody's against this idea. Nobody's against it. It's just a bunch of mothers and housewives." And stormed out of the room. So again, this is an example where an ordinary person could do this. And there's other examples I can't think of, but
you look back at like the earlier part of the 20th century in America, where, you know, I don't want to be like the jerk, you know, back in my day, but you know, we took education more seriously. There were a lot more of those things like that. People published those kind of works.
Andrew, I really don't have a question, but I do have a supporting comment in that Pelosi actually had a brief moment in the sun this past week in that a journalist published a 3-paragraph from Richard Rorty's book, Achieving Our Country. Was published in 1998. Richard Rorty was a pragmatist philosopher. And in these 3 paragraphs, he states that based on a couple of conditions, that America will succumb and eventually select a strong man. A strong man will rise up and be selected. And when the book was first published in 1998, some other philosophers said, yeah, his reasoning is sound and it's credible. However, they couldn't agree that America would ever succumb to a strong man.
You don't have to answer that.
Yeah, yeah. So I think he had a question.
I think it was about 500 years ago. One of the Greek philosophers said, by all means get married. If your wife turns out to be good, you'll be happy. If not, you'll become a philosopher.
You're saying something about my wife?
Well,
a bit of comment or kind of response to his, and that if you've ever been at a bar and talked to inebriated people, they're all philosophers. And the reality is most every political argument, if you parse out the facts and get rid of some of the issues there, it all comes down to a philosophical difference of opinion between the two parties on what course you should take given the facts at hand. And most every difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is not so much a difference in the facts at hand, but how what you should do with that, and whether or not indeed the alternative facts are even true in some cases.
So what I found myself, and this is probably true for many of you, is that, you know, there was all this stuff about fact-checking and whatnot, and that's all great, right? But it still doesn't get philosophical, right? But what I found is like when people would come to me and say, Andrew, you look this stuff up. Is this true and true? Is this true? Right. So they end up relying on my skills and expertise. So they'll give me some claim they hadn't heard. If you've seen any political claim from any spectrum, right? That's how we all go look at them. And typically, almost 90% of the time, this crazy political claim, no matter what part of the spectrum it comes from, is usually not true. Right. It's too good to be crazy. It's usually too crazy to be true. It's too good to be true. It's also too crazy to be true. And so, but what I have difficulty with is like, you know, I'm not a teacher, right? But then I try to, I have a friend, he's like 80, right? My mother's older than I'm 80, so it was basically my mother's age. And I cannot give this guy the tools by which to, the intellectual tools by which to, where he can do this himself. And by that I don't mean typing into the internet searching. I mean the cognitive tools by which he would then reason that, oh, look, here's a bunch of propositions, and these propositions might be reliable, and they contradict what you're talking about. Which one is more likely to be true, right? And to go through the reasoning process. Or to, for example, like I pointed out that the philosopher professor writing the book about writing philosophy talking about what's a philosophical problem. And he doesn't necessarily recognize the statements represent a philosophical problem, right? A conundrum. They're not obvious, right? How do you teach something? Well, you can't. You can't teach an ordinary person, right, on the street. And so that sort of plays into part of our issue, is that those skills aren't as prevalent as we would hope they would be in our democratic society. And I don't care what political spectrum you're from, they're useful no matter what political spectrum you're from.
I have a question and a comment, too. How many 100 philosophy departments have gone? And if you mention the word philosophy nowadays, people kind of roll their eyes back, and the philosophers have become more scientific in their writing, words about words and making up new words, and it's kind of almost impossible to understand what they're saying even. And I don't know if there's any professional philosophers in this room, but we're all interested in philosophy. It seems like we could go back to, basic questions like, why am I here? Where did I come from? What am I supposed to do with my life? How am I supposed to live it? That sort of thing. That religion doesn't answer all the time, and science certainly doesn't answer. So it's the purview of philosophy. So, tell us how we get back to it.
So when someone's asked the question, why am I here? Right? So I think that's an excellent, common way to talk about philosophy. Okay. Because the question itself presupposes a lot, right? It's the question itself presupposes you're here for a purpose, right? Well, I'm sorry, please justify that assumption. Why am I here for that justification requires that presumption bound into that question requires a justification. And so another one will be, and I don't want to get into philosophy, but who made you? Right. Oh, who were they? There's a who. Maybe it was a what. Maybe it was a set of who's. Right. Maybe it was more. So there's all these other possibilities. Right. And so it gives the notion that to come up with that and see that question is a philosophical problem is again a skill, and then someone else can learn that skill and then learn to question the questions. Right? So then that gives you a whole set of other knowledge to go for. Now let's say someone who said that to me says, well, who made you? And they're trying to convince me of a particular religious viewpoint. Okay. So they might then be taken aback and say, I find that defensive. It has to be a who, right? Because they're going to get uncomfortable possibly and say, I'm going to challenge my religion. So my response to that was, you should challenge your religion, because in fact, if you come out the other end believing that your belief was justified in your religion, how much better you are, feeling about your place in the world. So it shouldn't be a challenge to somebody, and they shouldn't feel afraid of that, be challenging that. They should, in fact, like I talked about with the argument for the uses of God, an example I gave, it's working at two theists working back and forth to get the belief right. So I think some of those kind of questions are good, not necessarily because we talk about answers, but you talk about the methods. That's what my opinion.
I kind of thought you would be talking about how, this internet era, and as you mentioned, you can get any facts at your fingertips on the phone, or non-facts or lies on the, but you can get a lot of information at your fingertips. And, back in when I was in school, there wasn't Wikipedia where you could look up anything, and you always hear educators and so forth disparaging Wikipedia as having a lot of non-facts, but I've found that in most cases Wikipedia is pretty accurate for things that I've looked up. Now we're encountering these people that publish outright lies or non-facts that have become more pronounced in the political arena, if you get on YouTube or something, you will be led from one thing to another because they know, this is a conservative person who's interested in this, and so you will be in this tunnel, this channel, where you're just getting facts that according to what you might already believe, and you're not getting any contrary facts. So and the other thing is, I used to publish scientific papers, and they always had to be refereed by three referees and go through an editor and be accepted by journals. Now a lot of scientific papers and other papers are published online because they want to get out there before somebody scoops them. So in this kind of environment, there's, how do we know, I mean, it used to be there were authorities who said, yes, this is the facts, and these are not the facts, but if there's all this stuff floating around out there, who becomes the authority for what is the truth and what is not the truth?
I don't know how to philosophically approach that problem.
Huh?
There's a great article online that you can find. I hate to say the great article online. But I don't know if you'll get the exact article I'm talking about, but it's called, Google the exact words, death of expertise. Oh. And so I don't know who wrote this, but I was giving this talk and a friend of mine's attorney said, oh, you should read this. And I think it was very interesting because it talked about, we have attorneys in the room, right? David Jerome is an attorney. But I'm not going to go to David Alkert for legal advice, right? Because he's a doctor, right? And vice versa, right? And I'm a software developer, right? I can tell you about something about the operation of your computer, but please don't ask me about, filing a lawsuit against your neighbor because you don't know anything about that. Right? But look up this death of expertise and he talks, what's interesting about this, he sort of models this person who doesn't believe in expertise as he goes through his article. Right, this like concept that we have an expertise. People have spent time honing a skill and understanding a bit of our civilization, and they're not necessarily believed because they went counter to it.
What he's saying is that even a quote scientific article nowadays doesn't have a peer review in order to be published. You know, in my day, if you wanted to have your article published in a journal, in a reputable journal, it had to be peer reviewed. And they would tear it apart if it was bad science. Nowadays, you just put it out there on the internet and say, well, this is science. I mean, Wikipedia likes people to reference back to original sources, but eventually, if everything is electronic, where are those original sources going to be that we're referring back to?
I've been into reading a book called...
Wait,
I've been enjoying a book called The Geography of Bliss by me. And it has taught me how there's an element of philosophy to everything in life. And without that, it seems as though we would have to be two-stepping to only a written law with narrow, very narrow freedoms. So could you comment on what that means to you?
Well, I mean, philosophy is a skill, and I'm raking leaves in the backyard. I have a house, I have to rake leaves in the backyard. I'm not doing philosophy raking leaves in the backyard, right? And I hate to be, more purient, but I got to go to the toilet, right? I'm not typically doing philosophy, and although sometimes it's a good time to do that.
Yeah.
By the way. But, nonetheless, you do these things in life which aren't philosophical, and you do them, right? So, and at one point, I guess I left out, which I kind of wanted to make, was bringing into civilization this is human beings went along and they were stabbing stuff with sticks and grabbing stuff out of trees and eating it and hoping they were going to live for the next day, right? And then they learned how to farm and we're actually going to be able to farm and get enough to eat, right? And we got that stuff. And at some point, later on, we got a big enough civilization, we start thinking about these questions, right? So those start to provide more meaning to us because we had time to sit around and answer those questions. So I really mean when I say that philosophy is one of the civilizing forces, and it doesn't matter which civilization we're talking about, it's a civilizing force.
I thought ignorance was bliss.
No. So, that's the best answer I have.
Anybody want to have a question?
Again, I want to try to help answer David's question. Is already said. Sorry. I think education has got to be a really important aspect of this. And starting early and teaching critical thinking at every level. And as adults, we still have I might disagree with you a little bit, but I still think we have a lot of people have the capacity to learn new things. And there's many places that you can learn and get new information. I've taken advantage of some of the free university courses that are online. One of the courses that I did, which was really interesting, was Understanding Arguments. It was by a philosophy professor at Duke University. It was a really good course and good testing question material. And I definitely learned something from it. I would say one other thing that's happening in the recent, most recent environment is that there are just new organization after new organization that is popping up locally to that have gotten motivated by the current environment. And it's an opportunity for people, thinking people, to participate in your country, your democracy, whatever. And I've been to a couple of meetings just the last weeks here of one is an organization that's going to be made up of leaders of nonprofit organizations, of faith-based organizations, of interfaith organizations, and other social justice organizations that's really kind of targeted towards protecting constitutional rights. So there's a good philosophical challenge for you.
Yeah, maybe that's, I mean, I don't want to say that's, I mean, I don't want to get political, right? But a friend, he's from Russia, and he grew up, and in fact, I just had, we left work early, and he came over in the 90s, so he grew up, he's born in the 60s, a little older than me, and so he grew up with the Soviets, right? And so he knows a lot about the living in that environment, right? And very interesting viewpoint to hear someone of that who's now been in the United States for this many years as an American citizen and voting and so on, taxi driver to engineer, right? I mean, that's an American story, right? And so it's important to, as we talk today, it's coincidentally, and I'm going to do this talk, you didn't know I was giving this talk about how the Soviet Union came about, forced certain people, they sort of forced these ideas upon people, the ideas that people weren't ready for. That's what he described it. There were sets of ideas. And think about that idea, right? Ideas people weren't ready for. And they forced it upon people whether they liked it or not. Okay? So that's an important thing. That's not a United States thing, but we see the consequences of that. I'm not trying to analogize that to America today. I mean, certainly I am. But the point is, you should always be ready. That's a person that ideas can be misused and they can be put in the wrong direction. It's not false to say that the Soviet Union and that the bad things that came out of the situation was a misuse of philosophical training and work. Okay. So that means that then if you kind of move into ethics, what should you do? What should you not do? Well, then you have the duty, if you believe it, to then maybe use philosophy to push those in the right direction, should, in fact, the wrong thing appear, right? In whatever country, whatever culture you're in. Right? Even if that doesn't happen, the fact that you put that out there and you, for example, teach it to people that they should be ready for this, hopefully then that carries on to the next generation, so they're ready for it. So I guess that's one way of commentary behind it.
Yeah. Don't you think that in this present time that philosophy or the way of philosophy is important in questioning, especially emotional or political, motivations. What is it that is really true? What is it that's the basis of your motives? Question things. I think that's where maybe philosophy. We have time for one more
question. A question over here.
Okay.
Most gentlemen got some more.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
A thought just occurred to me
about the United States and about our current situation. Do you feel that capitalism is compatible with philosophy? Because it seems like to me a lot of things what I've heard is an abandonment of the philosophy to achieve some particular material goal, a job or something. It doesn't really matter what my philosophy is, as long as I have this material capitalistic thing set up that make America America. Now, the one thing is it's kind of like it's like puzzling to me is how we just so quickly say, well, I don't really care about that right or that, as long as I can have a job.
So how I would approach it, I can't answer your question, but I can approach it this way. What is capitalism? Right? What does it mean to be capitalist? You know, to be a capitalist, right? What sorts of actions in an economy are capitalistic and which aren't? So that's the way to philosophically approach that problem, right? And then you might then try to fold ethics into that. So, well, if capitalism means X, right, and I'm doing X in an economy, is that better for people or worse, right? And so, like, I gave the example of James Jacobs, who's an urban planner, who said that it's better to have, you know, urban city streets as opposed to freeways bulldozing through them. So she might say, well, in fact, she did say this, local economy. Like, people who are free to have small-scale local economy are better for human beings. They make better human beings out of it. So that's like an example of folding in some other idea into capitalism. That's what we could call good capitalism, right? So I'm not saying these are like the ultimate answers to what I'm talking about, but I'm sort of giving an idea of what the approach is, right? So untethering folks like that, she would describe, she would say, that's good capitalism. Maybe there's a bad capitalism, right? I mean, so again, I'm not proposing that we know the answers, but proposing kind of how you might think about what you're talking about in a philosophical way.
They want to kick us out of here by 9 o'clock, so okay. One more question and then...
That's good. Yeah.
I have a quick question. Do you think part of the, what you might characterize as a decline in interest in philosophy has to do with as a more scientific understanding of human psychology, which you have used against us by, you know, all sorts of social psychology experiments which show how you can use, can manipulate someone's thought process, and that's now become
It's not so much that. And can I, as again, kind of with a degree in sciences, and I'm not a practicing scientist, so it's in graduate work. I get frustrated when I hear these studies. Well, you know, we did this thing, we talked about the moral questions, and we put a thing on the brain and they scanned them, right? Well, that doesn't tell me what to do, right? So the point is, ethics is an approach to things rationally. I want to know what to do. Right. And so the ideas of what is the meaning of something, what does it mean to know something conceptually in my brain, well, so what if I can, you know, strap something on my head and we can figure out what brain patterns mean when someone's conceiving of an apple? Well, that doesn't tell me. That still doesn't tell me what the taste of an apple is, right? So I put an apple in my mouth and I have a specific experience. But if you showed me those brain patterns, even if I understood the science behind it, I'd never tasted an apple before. I wouldn't know what an apple was like when you tasted it in my mouth unless you told me that's an apple. Right? So there's this disconnection between the experiences we have, we talk about what it is we're going to do, and we're going to talk about these things, these sciences, which in fact, yes, of course, we properly model the brain and whatnot. So I think they're kind of a distraction, especially when we talk about ethics. Because they don't tell me what I ought to do, right? What ought I have to learn? And that's just my take on it. I think it's misusing science. It's almost like this thing the pastor said, well, we're going to be able to predict anything in the world because we're going to know where all the atoms are and their states, and then once we know all the states and the atoms, we can predict any future event, right? And quantum mechanics rolls around and says, ooh, that ain't true. Right? But it's that kind of fantasy, right? I think that's the same kind of thing. It's like, well, we've explained morality now because we can model things in people's heads. I think it's the same kind of mistake. Anyway.